is we prevent replay attacks. So replay attacks is if I just send you the encryption of a value, then clearly I have made that message, but there's no guarantee that I have made this message now. So if somebody uses that message to authenticate to you, they could have gotten that message from me many years ago and is now just sending it to you. So the message must have some measure of freshness as well, right? And we look at some protocol examples, we looked at unilateral, mutual, and we also looked at that additional problem if you have data origin authentication with symmetric crypto, which was the reflection attack. So therefore we said generally to solve that, we always try to indicate the direction of the message as well by putting the identifier of the receiver into the message. Okay, so in today's lecture, we're going to look at key management. So key management is not a security service, but as a security area, you could almost argue that it's one of the most important. It's not very exciting, pretty much by standard, but it's incredibly important. So up to now, we've had a lecture on symmetric encryption, on asymmetric encryption, on data integrity. We talked about all these wonderful things, AES, RSA, MAX, hash, HMAX, CBCMAX, digital signatures. But we always did assume that there was key material available for those things to work, right? Key management relates to the entire area of security engineering that ensures that the people that need them have the appropriate keys, right? A long time ago, when we talked about Kirchhoff's principle, we said everybody knows everything about everything except people should not know keys. So how do we generate these keys securely, and how do we give it to the people that need to use them? Okay. So in this lecture, we look at two different things. We look at how we manage symmetric keys. In other words, how we manage keys for symmetric crypto systems. And then finally, we'll see how we manage asymmetric keys, or public key certificates, which is the most common way to do that. Okay. Even within the symmetric key management section, we can manage symmetric keys using other symmetric key systems, crypto systems, or we can manage symmetric keys with asymmetric keys. Right? So the goal for today is to look at the different concepts of managing a symmetric key using symmetric mechanisms. And then next week, we'll move on managing symmetric key with asymmetric crypto and managing asymmetric keys as well. Okay. So, in terms of key management, just like in the previous lecture, this lecture is actually based on a standard. So, it is standard ISO 11770, which is the security techniques for key management standard. And we will be using the same terminology, and we will be using the same protocol examples. Okay. So key management, as described in the standard, is actually a very, very big area. Okay, that involves very many different things. So first of all, we need to know how to generate a key. Right. So for a symmetric key, this is basically making a random bit string. Right? That is difficult for other people to predict. For public key crypto, this might be a little bit harder because you have to choose a variety of things. So that, for example, for Algol, you need a generator, you need to choose some primes that works. For RSA, you need to choose the two primes. You need to choose the public exponent correctly so that it's relatively prime to the phi of n, all sorts of things. So this is what key generation does, right? The second step is key establishment. So key establishment is maybe the main part of key management and what we will focus on in this lecture. So what does key establishment mean? So once we have made the key, we need to give that key to the person that needs it. So that process of giving the key or installing the key with the person that should use it is called establishment. So if I make a key and then I send it to Alice, I'm establishing that key by sending it to Alice. More likely, if Alice and Bob want to talk to each other, they need a new key, That process for them to make a key so they talk to each other, it is called key establishment, right? Basically exchanging the keys between each other. We also need to consider how to securely store the key, okay? So this might seem obvious because it's something that is very sensitive, so we have to put it in a secure place, but there's a lot of practical problems involving key management, right? For example, what if the device that you work on is not very secure? So for a long time, we had mobile phones, not as fancy as today entirely, because today includes trusted execution environments. We can do lots of nice security things quite securely. But the big thing about mobile phones is always that they're insecure, right? They have a memory space, they have a processor, they have all these apps living on them. They don't really have a proper operating system. The operating system was sort of made by the handset manufacturer. And now you're supposed to have apps that offer security, but like, where do you put the key? Do you just put it in the code? If you store it in memory, other processors can just read it. What is going on, right? So these days, as I said, there's nice trusted execution environments, trusted memory where you can segment memory between different applications, where you can securely store things in hardware, so even if somebody tries to hack into your phone and take it apart, the key is secure. There's also other people with cheaper applications who just simply say, I'm going to keep my key in the cloud. So the key is never going to leave the back end where it is secure. The application in the phone is only really the front end displaying things to the user, but the key actually doesn't go to the phone, right? So different things we can think about. And then that same problem happens with IoTs, not only mobile phones. We also need to think about key backup. So I make a key, I encrypt all the data in my company with this key, I have a little bit of a crash, the key gets corrupted, now I can get none of my data back. This is not a good idea, right? So we probably need to keep a copy of our key somewhere. But this copy of the key, we also need to think where we get stored, because it has to be stored at some place that is secure, that is not going to be affected when the original key breaks, all sorts of things, right? So basically, some of this might be quite manual. So you might actually say we have a secure disk somewhere, or a tamper-proof USB drive, and half the key is on that and kept by this guy, and half of the key is on another USB drive kept by another guy. And really, when something bad happens, these two guys can get together, put their USB stick into some device at the same time, you know, like they do in old movies when they have a key to open the really secret door. And this key can be reconstituted and we can get it back. Okay? But none of those people have access to the actual raw key. Then we need to actually use the key. Right, so if we get it out of storage, we use the key, and when we finish using the key, every single key is supposed to have a defined life cycle. So no key is supposed to live infinitely for the rest of time. Right? So what the standard actually says is every single key that you make should only work for a set time period. Okay? And then it should be changed. So a key can be changed because it has been compromised, because somebody got hold of it that shouldn't, or a key will change when it gets to the end of its life, basically to its expiry date, right? When it gets there, we have to change the key, and then the process starts again. When we stop using the key, we then destroy it so that no one else ever finds it, or in some cases, we might need to keep it. For example, let's say we had a public-private key pair, we signed a lot of documents with it, and now the private-public key pair comes to the end of its lifetime and it has expired. So now we are going to generate a new signing key. But there's still all these documents floating around that we have signed, and we might have to verify that we in fact signed them. So we might have to archive the public key that we can use to verify those documents. Right, and then we can destroy the private key. Right, so this is the big story with key management. And we're going to only look at this part. Right. So, in practice, usually your keys are kept in a special device, which is called the HSM, Hardware Security Module. So, it's basically like a very special server. You can get it in various form factors. The bigger ones are basically rack servers, right? So you can put it in a computing center, right? There are also small ones that you can plug into servers. So like an expansion card, like a graphics card, you collect it, put it inside the machine, and then it will do the management for you. So what is special about these things? They are completely trusted hardware, right? So they are a very secure hardware box. They have lots of hardware security measures in them. For example, if somebody tries to drill a hole in it, it will immediately erase everything. So there's a lot of hardware security measures and software security measures, right? And usually they are connected into the network like any other secure server. You can connect them via IPsec or TLS, and they can basically securely communicate with everything else. Right. They're also quite impressive. They can do almost every security algorithm you can think of. Asymmetric crypto, signing and encryption, symmetric encryption, encryption in Mac, can do hashes, can do key derivation, and it can do good quality random number generation. So most of these things, if you buy a good one, can actually do true random number generation. So in other words, it has an internal electronic or physical process that it can observe to basically make perfectly good true random numbers. Okay, so if you look at security architecture in the real world, you'll see these very often. Maybe there's a note on that. If anyone ever asks if people to do security audit, right? Sometimes people say, can you come do penetration testing? That means hack into my system. That's one thing. But normally when people say, here's an architecture, then you see if the architecture is okay. The main thing people want to talk about is the HSM and the security management. They always ask, is my key long enough? Should my key be longer? Is my key life cycle long, too long? Should I make it expire after 2 weeks instead of 2 years? Right? So as I said, it doesn't sound very exciting, but it's actually really, really, really important to make systems as a whole secure. It doesn't matter if you have the best crypto out there, if your key management then is insecure. Okay. So how do we manage symmetric keys? Okay. So the section that we are going to do today is how do we manage symmetric keys using symmetric key cryptography, right? So there are three modules in the system and you can define protocols for each. We can consider directly communicating entities. In other words, Alice and Bob talking to each other and there's only an Alice and a Bob. We can then talk about two different models where there's Alice and Bob plus a third person, and that third person is the trusted person that can help them generate this key. So that's referred to as the trusted third party, right? And trusted third parties can operate within two models. The trusted third party can be a key distribution center, or the trusted third party can be a key translation center, right? So we're directly communicating entities. We don't have this trusted third party, so we have Alice, we have Bob, and basically Alice and Bob need to talk to each other, and in this process they have to securely exchange a new key. So this is quite important. So when we talk actually about key establishment, all of the models that we have assumes that there's already a relationship between the people involved. In other words, here, Alice and Bob does not start off knowing nothing about each other. If that is the case, key establishment would be extremely hard, right? The assumption is that Alice and Bob already has a shared secret key, but they want to make a new one. How to make that first initial secret key exchange is sometimes not very well defined, right? And sometimes that is manual process. Alice and Bob will have to get together. There will basically have to be a person that goes between them with a piece of trusted hardware to put the key on Alice and that key on Bob. So that initial key is also extremely valuable. We will talk next week when we finish the section on symmetric keys about key hierarchies, right? So key hierarchy says at the top there's a master key, which is the very first key that Alice and Bob establishes. And that key is so difficult to establish because it almost has to be done manually every single time. Alice and Bob doesn't really want to use that key to do everyday business. So Alice and Bob will use that key to make other keys to do everyday business, but that key will be used very little. Because the less we use the key, the less likely it is to get it back. So we can leave that key for a very long time. Its life cycle can be extremely long. Whereas for the keys at the bottom, the life cycle might be a minute, right? Whatever. And then we can make a new one. So just remember that key establishment is always, even with the trust of third parties, considered to be between two things, between Alice and Bob. Okay, so the trust of third parties relates to distribution within a domain. So we have two possible cases. We can use asymmetric techniques, which we'll look at next week, or we can use symmetric techniques. So in other words, we can have a trusted third party, but the trusted third party, Alice and Bob, can still use symmetric method to exchange their new symmetric key. Right? So for the second case, we then have this key distribution center for this key translation center. Right? And for the key translation and the key distribution center, Alice and Bob already need a relationship with that third party. So when the system starts, they already have a shared key with that trusted third party. Right. Okay. So when we have this distribution within the domain, we have the key translation center, right? So we have this entity that transports keys between Alice and Bob. And if we have a key distribution center, we have this entity that makes sure that Alice and Bob agrees on a key. So this is the terminology. So there's a difference between transport and agreement. So just if you look at the words, it sounds a little bit like if we have transport, one person already has the key, and we are taking the same copy of that key to the other person. Whereas for key agreement, it probably means no one really has a key, and they are talking and negotiating a little bit to find the key. Right, and that would sound sort of right. Okay? So when we have the key translation center, what will happen is we have Alice, and we have Bob, and we have this trusted third party, which is the key translation center. Alice has a relationship to the KPC. Bob has a relationship to the KPC already, so they have a shared key with each other, right? Alice will tell the KPC, I want to talk to Bob. I already have a key that I want to use to talk to Bob. Can you help me give this key to Bob? So Alice sends this key to the key translation center. The key translation takes this key and sends it to Bob. Now Alice has the key, Bob has the key, and Alice and Bob can talk to each other. Right. This model can also be slightly different. Okay? Bob can also be a person that cannot directly connect to the KPC. In other words, Bob can be offline, but Bob can connect to Alice. In which case, Alice becomes its connection to the KPC. Okay? So, in this case, Alice will say, I'm here with Bob. I want to talk to Bob. Can you help me give the key to Bob? Alice will give the key to the KPC. The KPC will then tell Alice, okay, here is a message for Bob. Pass it along to Bob, and if you do that, Bob will also have the key, and Bob will be able to talk to you. Okay, so where is this useful in practice? This is useful for anything where we need crypto between Alice and Bob, but Bob is maybe not a very fancy device, right? Think about Bob as maybe a smart card, like a credit card, right? The credit card cannot directly connect to the internet, cannot directly connect to the key translation center, right? But Alice is a credit card machine, right? Where I want to use my card to make a payment. So if that card gets plugged into the machine, now that card is connected through the machine to the trusted third party, right? And the machine can then tell the trusted third party, I've got this card here, I need to make a payment transaction with it, but I don't share a key with it. Can you please send me a key? or a message that I can pass to this card, so we end up with a shared key. And the message will come back, Alice will then pass the message to the card can be encrypted, and then basically the card and the credit card machine can talk to each other. Right? And there might be some other needs for this model as well. That's just the simplest one that we can think of. Right. So the next model is the key distribution center. So remember, for key translation, we have transport. We have this key trade from Alice to Bob. In key distribution center, we have key agreement. Right? So here, Alice or Bob does not start with a key. So the simplest model is that Alice will tell the key distribution center, I want to talk to Bob, but I don't have a key to talk to Bob. Can you help us? And the key distribution center will say, sure. The key distribution center will then make a key, send that key to Alice, and then send that key to Bob. Right, and now once again, Alice has the key, and Bob has the key. But it's not this process of transport where the key is already there, and it goes from Alice to Bob. In this case, somebody else, that is not Alice and Bob, decided on what this key value was going to be. Okay, we can also have the offline method, right? We can basically say Alice is connected to Bob. Bob is not able to go online. Alice will ask the key distribution center to make them a new key. The key distribution center will send two messages back. One is intended for Alice. One is intended for Bob, right? And basically, once Alice has received her message and Bob has received his message, they can both decrypt that message. And basically now they have a shared secret key. Okay, so now we have talked about a lot of things. So what we can now do is we can come back to the things that we briefly mentioned or discussed and try and sort of formally write down what they mean. So the first thing is key establishment. So key establishment is this entire process of once we have a key, making this key available to the people that need to use the key. Right. The next thing is key control. Who has the ability to choose the key's value? Right. The key control is important because it determines whether we are dealing with key agreement or we are dealing of key transport. Key transport is Alice already has chosen the key. That means Alice has key control because Alice alone decided what that key value was. And then the key transport protocol helps her set that key to Bob. For key agreement, neither entity has key control. Right? So Alice doesn't choose what the value of the key is. Bob doesn't choose what the value of the key is. Alice and Bob might contribute parts of the key, but none of them are the only one available, responsible for making that decision. So that's why we could have something like the key distribution center, where Alice doesn't decide the value of the key, Bob doesn't decide the value of the key, the center decides the value of the key. So now neither Bob or Alice has key control, and that's an example of key agreement. Right? So if we want to think about that in a slightly different way, if we basically have a coffee room or a break room, and I install a key there, which is like a keypad, and I choose the entry code to be 1234, and then I send an email to everybody else saying, oh, the code to get into the break room is 1234, that would be an example of key transport, right? Because I chose the value of the key, I'm going to use the key myself, and now I've given that key to everybody else. I have decided what it's going to be. Alternatively, if I go somewhere to a hardware store and I buy an actual lock and I say, well, I just need to secure this room, can I have some key copies of the key and can I unlock? Then that is almost a simple example of key agreement, right? Because basically there's not a trusted third party, the guy at the hardware store. He's choosing the lock, he's choosing the key, and he's just making copies of the key, which he will then give to me, and I will pass along to you. So I don't actually choose what the key looks like, that the hardware store chooses what the key looks like, but I ended up using it with everybody else. final thing is key confirmation. So assurance that the other person actually has the key. Right. So what does this mean? So there's actually two different levels of key confirmation. Implicit key authentication and explicit key authentication. So what does key confirmation mean? When we run the protocol, we assume that at the end, Alice has the key and Bob has the key. So from Alice's perspective, when the protocol finishes, she wants to have some idea that the only other person in the system that now has the key is Bob. Both that Bob successfully received the key, and that Bob is the only one with the key. Right? So basically, if she thinks about implicit key authentication, Alice basically says, I've looked at the protocol, I trust the protocol, so when we are finished, I'm pretty certain that Bob has the key, and that Bob is the only person with the key, but I'm not 100% sure. In explicit key authentication, Bob will actually use the new key as part of the protocol. Right. So in other words, now Alice is very sure. Right? She knows that the protocol is secure. She knows that the key could only have gone to Bob. And now she also sees Bob using it as part of the establishment protocol. So now she's really sure that Bob has it. Once again, if we try to look at a slightly different example. Right? If you buy your friend maybe a gift, and you send it to them via a courier service. Okay? So you trust the courier service, you don't think they're dishonest. So you track it online, and then the status says that this package has been delivered to this address, and there's like a little thing that looks like a signature. Okay. So now because you trust the courier and the courier service, you now have an implicit idea that your friend has got the package. Because clearly the courier went to this address you specified and somebody there made a signature, like a little sweetie thing, right? So, you are pretty sure this worked. But also you're not definitely sure, right? Because it could have been like the guy in the apartment next door, right? Or they could have gone to the wrong address. We don't know. But we are pretty sure because most of the time this works. Either if your friend now messages you with a photo of the gift and say, hey, thank you, I'm so happy that I got this gift, then you are 100% sure, right? So that is the same here. That would be explicitly sure that this gift was received. So we just think about this gift as a key. So when we trust the process, and that's the only thing we could do, then at the end, when the process completes, we have implicit key authentication. If we have the process plus the other person actually uses the new key, then we are absolutely sure. Then we have explicit key authentication. Okay, so let's look at some examples. So the first one is the key establishment example 6 from the standard mechanism 6. It's for directly communicating entities. Alice and Bob must share a secret key KB. RA and RB are nonces. FA and FB are keying material. Right. So now we have Bob sending RB to Alice. Alice sends back the encryption of RA, RB, Bob, some keying material. This text field, like we saw with authentication, can basically be anything. And Bob sends back the encryption of KB, RB, RA, some further keying material, and some random text. And then the new key that Alice and Bob generates is the hash of FA and FB. Okay. So this is a good time now to say that key establishment goes together with authentication, right? You cannot get a key from somebody that you have not authenticated, right? That would be a very bad idea, right? So if I'm going to get key material from Alice, during this process, Alice should really be authenticated to me too. Otherwise, I'm going to get keys from anyone, right? So Alice is authenticated to Bob because of the random value. We have random value, freshness, and date origin authentication. And Bob is also authenticated to Alice because we have date origin authentication and freshness. So what do you think about the key management thing? Is this an example of key agreement? or key transport? In other words, who has key control here? And is this in, and when we think about key confirmation, is this a protocol that has implicit key authentication or explicit key authentication? I'll give you a minute to think about that.
Just need to listen.
Okay, so what do you think about key confirmation? Is this a protocol with implicit or explicit key authentication? Is the new key that Alice and Bob agrees on? So this key AB is their existing key they already have. And they're making a new key K. Is the new key K used anywhere in the protocol? No, right? So this is implicit key authentication. The new key is not actually used to do anything. What about key control? Is this transport or is this agreement? Does Alice have key control? Does Alice decide what the value of the key is? Does Bob decide what the value of the key is? The answer is none of them decides, right? Because it's a combination of what Alice gives and a combination of what Bob gives. So they both contribute to the key. That means none of them has key control, right? If we change that a little bit, and we basically said there was no FA here, and the key is just the hash of FB. Who would have key control now? Mm-hmm. Who's deciding on the value of the key by itself? Does Alice contribute anything to the key now? No, right? So in this case, the only person that decides on the value of the key is Bob. So now it would be an example of key transport, because Bob is the singular party that determines the value of the key, and that key is then sent to Alice. Okay. So let's go. Okay, next one. Key establishment mechanism 9. So this is with trusted third party, right? We have Alice and Bob. They share already key PAT with the trusted third party, and Bob shares BT with the trusted third party. Bob sends random value to Alice. Alice sends her own random value, Bob's random value, and identity of Bob to the trusted third party. Trusted third party makes a message that contains a message from Alice and a message for Bob. So the message for Alice contains Alice's random value, the keying material, the identity of Bob, some random text, it can be anything, encrypted with PAT. The message to Bob is encrypted with PBT, contains RB, F, and the identity of Alice. Alice gets this message, she uses it, she takes this message, she forwards it to Bob. At the same time, she also uses the new key that they agreed upon, PAB, right, to basically encrypt a new random number A, Bob's original random number, and then Bob in the last line responds by encrypting his own random value, Alice's random value, and sending it to Alice. Okay, so in this protocol, who is authenticated to who? What type of key control do we have? In other words, is this key agreement or key transport? And what level of key confirmation do we have? Implicit key authentication or explicit key authentication? Mm-hmm. What about authentication? Is Alice authenticated to trust a third party? No, right? There's no data origin authentication of this message. Is Bob authenticated to trust a third party? No, right? Because the only thing that goes from Bob to trust a third party is this random value. So we have some freshness with no data origin authentication. Is trust a third party authenticated to Alice? Yes, because Alice gets this message, could only have been encrypted with PAT. We trust the third party knows, and Alice's random number that she sends to trust the third party is inside. So we have data origin authenticated, regions. Is trust the third party authenticated to Bob?
No.
Yes, right? Because even though trust the third party doesn't talk directly to Bob, she sends Alice this message that Alice can send back to Bob, right? And inside it is Bob's nonce, encrypted with PBT, which is something only trusted third party can do. So we have data origin authentication and we have freshness. Is Alice authenticated to Bob? Yes, because Alice makes this encryption with the new key AB and includes in it Bob's nonce. So we have freshness, data origin authentication. Similarly, Bob sends back to Alice with the new key AB, Alice's nonce. So we have freshness and that origin authentication. So Bob is authenticated to Alice. Right? So Alice is authenticated to Bob. Bob is authenticated to Alice. Trust the third party is authenticated to Alice. Trust the third party is authenticated to Bob. Why is it particularly important that trust the third party is authenticated to Alice and Bob? Because trust the third party gives them the key. Right? This value F is here as the key. So it would not be very good for Alice and Bob accepting keys from people that they have not authenticated. Right? That would be bad. So in terms of key management, is this an example of key transport or key agreement? Does Alice alone decide what the key would be, or Bob alone decides what the key would be, or do they have no say in the matter? They don't decide, right? So trust the third party chooses for them. Therefore, they don't have key control. Therefore, this is key agreement, right? In terms of implicit or explicit key agreement, does Alice absolutely know that Bob has the key or not? Is Alice just trusting the process, or does she see B using the key? B uses the key, right? Similarly, Bob sees Alice using the key. So not only does the protocol establish the key to Alice and Bob, it also does something to ensure that Alice definitely knows Bob has the key, and Bob definitely knows Alice has the key, right? So there's explicit key authentication, both of Alice's key to Bob and Bob's key to Alice, right? So what we basically have here is this model, right? Alice has asked the key distribution center to give a key that she can talk to Bob with, but Bob is not online. So the key distribution center makes a message for Alice, and a message for bar. Right. So we remember this protocol, then we also remember this one from the last lecture. Alright? So the last lecture we looked at this protocol from the perspective of authentication. But it is actually a key establishment protocol. And it is basically trying to do this. Alright? The biggest problem here, as we said last time, and linking to the fact that we said we shouldn't take keys from people we haven't authenticated, it has a weakness, because the trusted third party gives Bob the key with this message, but this message has no thresholds. So S is never authenticated to Bob. So the weakness of this protocol is therefore that if I'm an attacker and I could observe this transaction between Alice Bob and the trusted third party, and then later on, let's say many years from now, I manage to break this key and I learn what PAB is. But now this is not very useful to me because Alice and Bob hasn't used that key for a very long time. However, I can now go and try to get Bob to reinstall that key. Because I can simply say, hey Bob, I'm Alice. We are going to ask a trusted third party to give us a key. Hello, here is your key message, which is the one from 2 years ago, right? And Bob will say, okay, this was made by the trusted third party because it's encrypted with VS, that's great, and I am now going to use this PAB, and I'm going to use this PAB to authenticate to Alice to make sure that Alice is real. But of course, Alice has the key, not Alice, it's somebody else, but whoever is pretending to be Alice has the right key now, so she can respond to Bob, right? And basically, she can give the right response to Bob. Right, so it is broken because there's no thresholds. So in this protocol here, this is fixed by taking this RB. Right, so basically, if we try and sort of apply what was happened before, Bob is going to send like RB here, and this message that comes back here is going to include RB. Right, which is also going to be over here. And it's going to be sent by Alice to S. So we have freshness in that message. So the reason I have this protocol is actually because it's very famous. Like in academia, it's a very famous protocol. It's called the Needham and Schroeder protocol. Right? And it was one of the very first protocols that tried to do key establishment. Right? It is also famous because the Needham Schroeder protocol was absorbed into Windows Server 2000. The beginning of the century to be its ticket granting services protocol. Right? Not with this vulnerability, they fix it by using a timestamp for questions. Right? But you can see that many years later, almost exactly the same protocol, just with the freshness issue solved, is still being used in practice. Okay, so that is all I want to talk about today for the lecture. So we can have break now, and then we can have the tutorial, and I will discuss the tutorial solutions with you at